from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, in the hour ahead, suicide rates in the United States rose by 24% between 1999 and 2014. That's according to the National Center for Health Statistics. Despite suicide's growing prevalence, many people remain uncomfortable talking about it, adding to the tragedy and grief when a loved one kills him or herself. Our guests in the hour ahead share their stories of coping with the suicide of a loved one, and that's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. The National Center for Health Statistics reports that suicide is at its highest level in 30 years, with increases in every age group except for older adults. In this Forum hour, we talk about a subject all too often not talked about, and that is suicide, but we especially want to focus this hour on the effects on loved ones of those who choose to take their lives and how the loved ones grieve and cope and manage loss and bereavement. And we have three people here in studio who have all suffered, unfortunately, the tragedy of a loved one committing suicide. Let me tell you who they are and introduce you to them. John Brooks is the author of a book called The Girl Behind the Door, A Father's Quest to Understand His Daughter's Suicide. He's here with us and we welcome. Good morning.
Thanks, Michael.
We also welcome Joyce Brady, who is here with us in studio this morning, who lost her 52-year-old son to suicide. Her son's name was Devin, and we welcome you, Joyce Brady. Good morning.
You.
Eli Merritt is a psychiatrist at Merritt Mental Health and also the author of Suicide Risk in the Bay Area, a guide for families, physicians, therapists, and other professionals. He lost his mother to suicide when he was 6 years old. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. And it's a tough subject to talk about, a tough subject to reflect upon. But John Brooks, let me begin with you because part of the reason you wrote this book, I know, is to try to make sense out of it and to try to find a way to move forward. Let's just talk about that whole notion of making sense out of it and moving forward. Those are two big questions that loom over, you know, the real tragedy and torment of those who suffer, who are the loved ones.
Yeah, I think that a lot of parents who have lost children, particularly in a very violent or tragic manner, feel the need to do something. They want to make a difference. They want to keep their child's memory alive. They want to make sure that their child didn't die in vain. And they want to give their own life purpose when the purpose has been lost. So you see this in the parents who lost children in Newtown, Connecticut. They're lobbying for gun laws. So people become lobbyists. They want to change laws. In my case, I've been involved in that, but I also wrote a book about it. And it was really about trying to understand why she did it. Why did a 17-year-old girl, Redwood High School student, had everything going for her, why would she choose to check out? What did everybody miss? And what could we learn from it? And so it was a journey that took me, well, it took me about 3 years to write the book. But it's taken me 8 years since she died to, I guess you could call it moving forward. I've heard over and over again from people, get over it and move on. You can't move on from something like this.
No, it lasts a lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, and people talk about closure, which is a nonsense word in my judgment.
Right.
You live with this probably every day of your life. But you can move on, and I think it's a testament to the resiliency of the human spirit in your case and in the others that you have been able to in some respect, move on despite the mourning that's with you. What about the riddle? I mean, you want to solve a riddle here, and maybe it's a riddle that's beyond solving?
Well, I think, you know, what I've learned about suicide since Casey died was that it could happen for all sorts of reasons. I mean, it could be bullying. It could be peer pressure. And I'm just talking about teenagers and young people. For Casey, I think the issue was much deeper. I spent probably the first couple of years after she died being angry at the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I still am. But I really dove deeper into why she did it, because there was nothing obvious. There was no real trigger event. I mean, she got into college. She was going to be on her way to Bennington in Vermont. So in my case, Casey was adopted. She spent the first year of her life in a Polish orphanage when we received her at about a year and a half old. And what I learned too late was that that experience, that trauma, that early separation from the mother in infancy and being institutionalized leaves some really deep-seated wounds that nobody could really see.
She wouldn't show.
She wouldn't show. I don't even think she knew. But you're right. I mean, so much of suicide is so shameful and so stigmatized that people don't want to call attention to it. They don't want to call attention to themselves.
The sirens of the Golden Gate Bridge, though, are real. I mean, there's so much impulsivity and ideation of suicide there. It's almost something that I want to stray away from talking about, because there are some studies that show that even talking about suicide can be a catalyst. But what we're trying to do is prevent it as much as we can, and because in so many cases there are people who have jumped off and lived, not a lot of cases, but a significant number, and said, you know, if somebody had interfered or there had been a barrier, we've done a lot of shows on this, it might have made a mistake, been rectified as a mistake. About two-thirds of those survivors, in fact, realized that right after they stepped off, they could have done something other if somebody had interceded or so forth.
Yeah.
She was in pain, though. I mean, that's really kind of what it boils down to in many cases, doesn't it?
She was in much deeper pain than we thought. After she died, it was as if she wiped her hard drive clean. We couldn't really find much of any clues, but we did stumble into messages that she posted on message boards, in anonymous chat rooms and things like this, that revealed that she was much further out there than any of us thought, even her friends. Her friends didn't know. In fact, she went to the bridge twice. She went, we had a big fight one weekend. But, you know, parents fight with their kids. They argue with their kids. And she took our car on a Sunday night after my wife and I went to bed, and went to the bridge, and Sunday was probably going to be the day, but the gate was locked. She turned around and went home. And she even wrote a text to a friend of hers that basically said, I can't believe what I just did, and I hope I never do such a thing again. But then Tuesday morning, at about dawn, she went back. So you would have thought that the impulsivity had passed, and that moment had passed, and then she could go on from there, but she didn't. So it was something deeper, and it was really buried somewhere in her infancy.
We're talking again with John Brooks, who's here with us in studio. His book is The Girl Behind the Door, A Father's Quest to Understand His Daughter's Suicide. Writing it helped you immensely, I think, didn't it?
Well, a lot of people have asked me if writing the book was cathartic. And when I hear cathartic, I think, did it make you feel better? Not really.
It didn't cathartic really means just a purge, a purgation.
Right. Yeah. It really gave me something to do, and it gave me an outlet, some kind of an outlet and some kind of a purpose, and that's what I needed. I still need it.
Let me bring Joyce Brady into this. She's a mother. She lost her 52-year-old son, Devin, and it began with a concerned call from one of Devin's friends.
Yeah. I got a call from his friend that said he couldn't he's been texting him and he hasn't answered. And their conversation had been one of, as his friend called it, suicide ideation. So family member went to check, and at that time we found out that the police had already arrived and he was dead.
Were you aware of the suicide ideation?
Well, was I aware of it? Not recently. What I was aware of is that a year and a half before, he sort of withdrew, and he was always a close child to me. He withdrew. But I knew other people who saw him, so I just figured he's a grown man, you know, leave him alone, let him see what he's doing. But he was a hit-and-run victim when he was 21 years old. He was on a bicycle, and he was a hit-and-run victim and had a subdural hematoma. And after he had to not go to school finish his college for half a year, until a half a year later. And he received therapy at that time for depression after that subdural hematoma. And so he has always had some sort of therapy, you know, along the way. And he finished college. He did well. He went to Europe. He's a musician. He's an artist. But, you know, every now and then he would get low feelings.
But for the most part, it seemed like he was making it okay, despite what happened to him at age 21.
Yeah, and one day he sat me down and he said, "Look, Mom, you're getting older. What do you want to do about your death?" And I said, "Well, I just want to be cremated, that's it." He said, "Oh, no, 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 your friends do not want you to just go like that." So he had me give him the names of all my friends, get pictures of me from young to old, you know. And then when this happened, I said to myself, I should have been the one doing it for him.
That was a big clue.
That, you know, I should have been the one doing it for him, because he always said, "Your friends really love you, and I want to make sure something's great for you." So mine was pretty much a shock. I'm not looking into why he did it or anything like that. I know it must have been a desperate feeling that he had at that moment. What I'm doing is trying to understand how I can have a life still filled with him that I love and keep going.
And how do you do that?
Well, how I do it, well, one of the things that I did was someone told me to call the San Francisco Suicide Prevention and to get part of a grief group. And this was within 3 weeks. And she said, be with other people who have the same denominator, suicide. Don't just go to an HMO where just because someone died. And I think that was the beginning. The beginning was to sit in a circle with other people who were also affected. Some of them were there 10 years after, some of them were 2 years after. But that was, and get the guidelines. And those guidelines I've used with my family. I now look at my family as my grief group, and I give them the respect I gave to those other people, not forcing them to talk or not talk, things like that. I had an immediate side effect. That morning, after my first grief group, I woke up and it was morning. It wasn't in the middle of the night. I wasn't agitated. I had a good night's sleep. And so that was the beginning of taking care of myself about the loss of this child that I love so much.
What about guilt? I mean, did it weigh on you heavily?
Well, there is guilt about what could I do. You know, I have the mother fantasy that, you know, I can solve all problems. And if I only had done this, maybe I shouldn't have given him his two years. I did have it, but I know that I'm not responsible. I know that he made a desperate decision at a desperate time for himself that was considered right for him.
You both loved art, so that's remained kind of a way to stay connected to him.
The virtues that we both love art. He was an artist. I have a passion for art, and that's a virtue that we shared. And every time I walk through the De Young, he's with me. Every time I see beautiful colors, he's with me. And so I want to live what I loved with him.
Poetry has helped too?
Poetry for me has been just absolutely wonderful. I woke up the third night after his death and I screamed out, "I want you back." Mm. I want you back. That was my primal feeling. I want you back. And so I wrote it later, and then it turned out to be a little statement that I wrote about him. I don't know if you have time, I could just tell you what it was.
Please.
It's called Longing. Every guy furiously pumping bike pedals uphill past my window pane reminds me of you. Every tall shadow at the front door is you steadying your bike while I answer the bell. A quick change of light bulbs, make my computer work, deliver that must-see DVD you're excited about. I can't let you go. I want you back. Not the final ashes in some old urn, but my tall, beautiful son with the smiling eyes, safe from death's narrowing glance.
Okay, Joyce Brady is with us in studio, lost her 52-year-old son, Devin, to suicide. That was what year, Joyce?
It was 9 months ago.
Just 9 months ago. Wow. We also have Eli Merritt with us. He's a psychiatrist at Merritt Mental Health, an author of Suicide Risk in the Bay Area, a guide for families, physicians, therapists, and other professionals. Lost his mother to suicide at age 6, which is, I mean, it took you decades to really move on, as we've been hearing from John Brooks and as we're hearing from Joyce, right? I mean, you're just so vulnerable at that age, so incredibly vulnerable. Your mother is everything.
I think that's exactly right. And so, as you mentioned, I'm a psychiatrist, and I don't think it's by accident that I went into medicine, a healing field, and then within that chose as a specialty psychiatry, which is designed to help us psychologically heal. But, one way that I think of that question of, you know, my journey and my mother's loss is that it's helped me to become what I think of in the psychotherapy I do, a grief expert. And so one way I think of it is I spent I'm 49 now. I spent about 30 years, and these are the two, I think, two of the most important aspects or feelings or emotions related to loss by suicide. I spent the first 30 years really working through feelings of grief, and it took 40 years to work through the feelings of shame. So I think that I have great interest in both of these two, in both a personal way and also a psychotherapeutic way.
Forgive me, but shame that your mother, who was bipolar, killed herself?
Yes. I think basically shame, one of the things that's so important about shame and distinguishes it from other social emotions is that it is one that's largely born of community reaction and cultural influence.
So as a kid, you had to say, you know, my mother's gone, and you knew why she was gone and all of that, and you didn't know if other kids knew and so forth.
That's right, although really I think what happens with shame is it produces silence. And so it's really the silence and the avoidance of the topic of suicide and loss by suicide that's so significant. I do have one memory in elementary school of being in the cafeteria lined up to get my lunch. And you don't know whether at age 7 or 8 whether it's a true memory or something that you stirred up in your own thoughts. But there's a whispering from the corner, that's the kid whose mother killed herself. So that's a memory that I have. But really, I'm very interested in this subject now. Obviously, I wrote the book. And the thing that really interests me the most is something that I've been describing as a suicide complex. And that's not to say within the person who dies by suicide, but that we as a culture on many different levels, our culture, our society, and then also within schools and within families, we do often the exact opposite of what we should do or what benefits those who are actually, whether it's someone who is in bereavement by suicide or a person who's depressed and maybe having suicidal thoughts. In one of the presentations I give, I show what happens due to this suicide complex surrounded by shame, guilt, fear, disgust, and other factors that interfere, and a big stop sign comes up. So I think we end up avoiding conversation where really the thing that's the most therapeutic and helpful is to be able to talk about your experience and unravel the internal knots.
It's a lot of torture that people go through, though, torment, especially in terms of self-blame. And what to do about that and how to really get at that has always seemed to me one of the thorniest and most difficult problems, even for a talented and gifted psychiatrist who, you know, may have a great deal of ability and experience. You've been working with teens at Gunn High School, I know, for example, too. What do you suggest particularly just about preventing suicide? If a loved one feels that, there's, by the way, an excellent column I've asked that it be put on our website by Jody Allard in the Washington Post, just trying to save her son because she knew that her son was ideating suicide all the time and just wanted to keep him alive and was feeling, I've got to do anything I can. And yet at the same time, she's giving him slack and saying, you know, okay, you want to stay home from school because you're staying depressed. And she said, no, I have to – and her psychiatrist actually told her, you have to keep, you know, the kind of barriers, whatever they may be, and be the kind of parent you would naturally be inclined to be instead of, you know, catering to and being solicitous to. Where do you fall down on that whole area?
No, I think I agree with what you've said, that kind of maintaining good and healthy boundaries within the family in spite of depression, in spite of suicide risk is very important. But in this context, I would say sort of as a first step is the importance of recognizing when someone who's close to you is depressed and maybe goes a step beyond that into kind of a next phase of depression, I think of, which is into hopelessness. And then the next phase of that is angling into suicidal thoughts.
Excuse me, is this like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross or different phases that you can actually track and map?
I think so. It's something that I've come up with, but I haven't heard depression and suicide risk talked about in exactly this way, but I think that's probably a pretty good analogy. And I think is to recognize how much we avoid this topic. Again, to kind of I talk a lot to mental health professionals, to recognize the suicide complex within is a first important place to start. But then for family members, something I'm working on now and have written about in the book is something called deep emotional talking about it. What I recommend is if you have a family member who has had a suicide attempt or if you really understand that suicide risk is something occurring, is you take out pencil and paper and you go and you really give deep contemplative thought to what's going on. You really look deeply at what your core feelings are. And at the end of the day, the feelings that people have when they are thinking about someone close to them dying by suicide is feelings of love and grief. And then actually going to the individual, finding the right moment, and actually speaking to them in a way that I call deep emotional talking about it. There are a number of stories I have where family members or friends have taken this approach to speaking to loved ones, and I think it's one of the most important anchors that can occur. Suicidal thinking is often a form of very delusional thinking. There's a real disconnect between the perception of reality and the actual reality. So I think we bring the real reality into someone's life, which is how much you love them, how much they matter to you, and find a way to actually communicate that. And the more tears that are involved at that moment of communicating it, the better.
That's all excellent advice, and appreciate your wisdom on that. But let's get back to how to help kids who are dealing with the death of suicide, say, by a parent, or parents who have to deal with the death of a child by suicide. I mean, you know, I know there's no easy formula or prescription here, but, you know, you've written the book. What are you telling people?
I think that – so you're talking about now for family members, those who are bereaved by suicide, right?
Exactly.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is, as you mentioned earlier, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the stages of grief is the starting point to understand how complex grief alone is. But then there's an entity that's been described that I think is very accurate called complicated grief. So any loss of a family member or a close friend or spouse, whatever the degree of relation is, it automatically falls into a category of being complicated grief. So these issues of shame and blame and anger will be coming up in intense ways well beyond the typical, though very complex, stages of grief described by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So I think the real importance is, and that's the main theme of my book, which is talk about it. Find a way to talk about it. And for complicated grief in particular, there's not a lot of research on that subject, but that interpersonal psychotherapy has been found to be a helpful opportunity to talk about and work through those more complex emotions.
Did you get help when you were a kid? Is there any?
No.
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 You just had to go through the decades and go through the years.
No, I got into a pretty significant existential depression for most of my 20s, at which time I really began to do the work of, I think, understanding and experiencing the grief which had been buried for, well, 14, 15, 16 years.
Eli Merritt, again, is psychiatrist at Merritt Mental Health, author of Suicide Risk in the Bay Area. He lost his mother to suicide when he was 6 years old. And we're talking with those who have lost loved ones to suicide and also, indeed, want to hear stories from you if you have stories to tell. Especially would appreciate some who have worked their way through, again, there's no closure to this, but worked their way through some of the shame and the guilt and really the pain that goes with losing a loved one to suicide. You can join us with your questions or comments or stories, and we invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, you're invited to participate in the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @kqedforum. Do welcome your participation. Losing a loved one to suicide, if you've dealt with it, let's hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the aftermath of suicide, on the effect it has on loved ones, losing a loved one to suicide. And John Brooks is with us. He is author of The Girl Behind the Door, A Father's Quest to Understand His Daughter's Suicide. He'll be speaking, by the way, at Books, Inc. in Alameda tomorrow, 7 p.m., and at Books, Inc. in Palo Alto on Monday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. Eli Merritt is also with us. He's a psychiatrist at Merritt Mental Health and author of Suicide Risk in the Bay Area, a guide for families, physicians, therapists, and other professionals. He lost his mother to suicide when he was 6 years old. And Joyce Brady, who's lost her son, her 52-year-old son, Devin, to suicide. Joyce, I was going to ask you, because, you know, John wrote this book, went through this whole attempt to really understand his daughter's suicide, and Eli, obviously, becoming a psychiatrist, had a lot to do with trying to understand his mother's suicide. Your son didn't leave a note, and for some people, that's really difficult to deal with. There's an extraordinary graphic novel by Art Spiegelman where he talks about his the torment he goes through because his mother didn't leave a note. But you didn't seem, I mean, what struck me about when you told your story, you didn't seem to be obsessed with or need to find a reason.
I don't think I'll ever know the reason. I don't think I'll have prepositions about, you know, what might have happened. But I don't think I know. I will ever know. I will ever know. And so I don't spend my energy trying. I thought of it, but it's just getting me nowhere.
Futile.
It's getting me nowhere, and it's not aiding my healing to keep pondering why. It's just like, I want you back. I mean, that's what I want, him back, but I can't have him back. So what's the next level after that? The other thing that I've learned is that grief is a virtue. It's not, people talk about your grief. Grief is a virtue because it says I have loved. It says I have loved. They are together. And so when people say get over the grieving, it's like get over the loving. Can't get over the loving.
That's wonderfully put. Let me go to callers. Let's begin, Kamal, with you. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I live in the North Bay in Marin County, and 5 years ago I lost a 20-year-old daughter to suicide, who at one time was a student at Redwood High School. And needless to say, that was a devastating and probably, well, not a probably, the worst experience I ever had in my life. And I was really afraid that I would never recover from it. And I determined that I needed and I had to live on. And so I did do a lot of intentional grief work. I still do. It started with individual counseling, grief counseling, post-suicide with my wife. Then we went to group counseling, and I found a fantastic resource. I don't know if I can say it. It's a book.
Of course, say it.
It's called Healing After Loss by Martha W. Hickman. That book helped all of us, a wife and two other older children, to deal with this experience. And I, since that time, did a lot of reading online, also materials about suicide, and I just prayed and asked God to help me to do the things I could not do, because there were points in this journey where it was just too much for me, and I knew that I didn't have the strength or the wisdom or the fortitude or whatever it took to be on the other side. And so all of these things, along with the support of friends and availing myself of therapy, clinical therapy, as well as going to day-long retreats that help me with my spirit. I'm a pastor, and so that why question, certainly, you know, how could that happen to me, was quite a thing. But I also realized that we had no clue. This was not, we didn't have any sense that this was, my daughter was near this, and she wasn't here. She was in Los Angeles. So we didn't put eyes or hands on her. We didn't know exactly that this was even a possibility. It came as a complete shock. There was no note, no explanation, no anything. And so I know initially I went through a long thing about what could I have done differently? What kind of parent was I for this something to happen? And then I started second-guessing all of these things in my life. Well, if I had just done this, if I had just let her do this, or if I had just stopped this from happening. And I realized that, let's say, even though I didn't believe it, let's say I was the worst parent in the world. But right now, thinking like that isn't going to help me. And so I decided to stop asking all the what could I have done questions and focus on living on, because I knew that I had life to live yet, I had love to give and receive yet, and I had much to do in this world. And so that's where I've been trying to walk.
Well, Kamal, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss, and I mean that sincerely, and thank you for being so open with us and for telling us your story. I really appreciate it, and thank you for the call. I'm struck also by the fact that faith helped him. Are any of you helped by faith at all?
I had a different experience, unfortunately.
This is John Brooks.
We had attended a church for 15 years. Casey had gone there since she was in kindergarten. And I think Casey's suicide just made everybody uncomfortable. And I realize that's probably unfair to say, but people just wanted to – they behaved as though – they didn't want to talk about it. They almost wanted to pretend Casey never even existed. There was just that awkwardness. So we just – I felt alienated. I just felt like we were on a different sides of a glass wall. And then I joined the fight for a suicide barrier on the bridge and was shocked to find out that people in my church, people who had known her since she was in preschool, were against a barrier. And they knew her. And I was stunned at that. So – I'm sorry to say, I just became very disillusioned.
I understand. What you hear often people say is well, somebody dies of cancer and you feel all this mournfulness and empathy and so forth, but somebody dies of a suicide, it's like you don't talk about it. You kind of avoid talking about it. I mean, and it may be, you know, due to something mental in the same way that cancer is due to something physical, and yet it's avoided as being verboten.
Yeah, well, I mean, even the language around suicide is different from other kinds of death. And every kind, and every loss is tragic. But, you know, you read in the newspaper, somebody died peacefully or they died after a valiant battle with fill in the disease. But you commit suicide. As if you were committing a crime.
As if it's a volition, right. Totally. I want to read a comment from a listener named Angelique who writes, "My husband jumped off a cliff 21 months ago, leaving me to raise our two children by myself. We are still heartbroken, but my kids and I have managed to live, cope, and experience joy. I've learned that life is a gift that we cannot squander. However, memories of his last few weeks and days sometimes haunt me, and I can't stop thinking about his death. If I knew he was suicidal, I would have done and said different things. I know intellectually that his death is not my fault, but that doesn't make me regret all those things any less. This is the painful reality of suicide loss." Agreement from everybody. Yeah, let me go to another call here, and that's Deborah. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a pastor also. I've been struggling with depression for many, many, many years. And many years ago, I did have a suicide attempt. And I can tell you that as those of you who have lost someone to suicide, I'm so sorry. There is no way to comprehend what you have been and are going through. I can tell you as someone who tried it, though, that you didn't miss anything. We keep it as big a secret as we can as well. And what stopped me from... The question is usually, do you want to harm yourself or others? And I would try to say that the reason I don't want to harm myself is that I don't want to harm others. I just want to say that I'm sorry for you, and I never meant it anyway, so you didn't.
Oh, thank you, Deborah, for that call. I'm struck, Dr. Merritt, let me go to Eli Merritt here. Psychiatrist and author of Suicide Risk in the Bay Area, at how often people talk about suicide as anger against the self as opposed to talking it in the context of, that brings up the volition thing that John Brooks was talking about. In other words, kind of separating it from volition in a way and saying, you know, how can these people do this to their loved ones, like Deborah just mentioned, when frequently you're talking about a mental health difficulty that just... There's no way to intercede. I mean, and then when people say, if I could have done something, if I had said something and so forth, they're not reckoning with just how strong sometimes this mentally can be turning into impulse.
I'm
saying this rhetorically, but sure. I'm interested in your response. Yeah.
I'm very interested in, I think here, a concept of doublethink when you bring up what indirectly brought up various models of the mind. We live in a historical period in psychiatry where the upswing of the pendulum is very strong towards what you can call a biomedical model or the biological model or the genetic model. And so you bring up the – I believe that goes back to sort of through Freudian strains, the idea of anger itself. I think we have to be very open-minded to the complexity of not only the human emotional experience but particularly something as deep and profound as depression, despair, hopelessness, and suicide. One of my greatest interests is that when a person comes to that place of thinking about suicide, really one of the things, among others, that we're dealing with is an existential crisis. We have to remember, trying to remember from Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be, he talks about taking arms against a sea of trouble. So we're really, I think one of the things that we need to do is this idea of doublethink that comes from George Orwell. We really have to recognize that it can be anger towards self and also a genetic disorder occurring at the same time and not fall victim to black and white.
Well, we're talking about genetic disorders and Hamlet, and I tend to think often in literary terms it's a strength and a weakness, I guess. I'm thinking about David Foster Wallace, who is an author who is much beloved, who wound up killing himself. I'm interested in hearing a psychiatric perspective of this. He was on meds and he was doing okay, but he was like a zombie. I mean, the meds were having all this effect on him, suffering from terrible depression. And, you know, his wife and his loved ones found it very difficult to deal with him. He didn't have his vitality, didn't have his humanity, really, when he was so zoned out on psychotropics or whatever you want to call them. He goes off the meds and suicide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think complex issues here. Again, the importance, I think, of taking all of the best forms of treatment that we have. Two of the most dominant are clearly the psychopharmacology and then also psychotherapy. What we are seeing, and research supports this, is we are seeing a strong uptick in psychopharmacology and a significant downtick in psychotherapy, which, again, particularly for those more severe illnesses such as depression with despair and hopelessness and suicide risk, it's a tragic loss, I think. And interestingly enough, I've given a number of talks, and every time I give talks, mainly they're to mental health professionals. And I always ask, who here has ever had a course and how to treat suicide risk? I want to distinguish. People have had courses on how to assess suicide risk and what to do and where to take someone if they have acute suicide risk. But I ask repeatedly, who has ever been educated in the treatment of suicide risk? Never has a hand gone up.
And who's educated in dealing with suicide in the aftermath of? I mean, we really don't have enough resources along those lines. This is one of the reasons we wanted to do this program. And I want to bring more of our callers on. Mary Ann from Livermore, join us, please.
Thank you. I am 80 years old. My father committed suicide just before my 39th birthday, and my mother died of metastasized cancer 3 weeks later. And I could not talk about either death for at least 14 years to myself or really anyone else. I had great anger with both of them. These both deaths, my mother didn't tell me that she was dying. So both deaths were connected in a way, and I had great anger, as I said, a shame for myself. When my sister tried about 10 years ago to commit suicide, we were told that this is chemical depression in the family. And at this time, I know that family might be carrying that nasty gene, but there is success. My sister is alive. She reasonably loves life, and there is hope. And for me, I've learned a lot of strength, and to be honest with my children and other people about these sad things.
Well, thank you, Mary Ann. It's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your calling. And here's a listener comment. Depression is a sometimes temporary brain imbalance or disease. Unlike a broken arm, it's not easily visible, yet needs to be treated without prejudice. After we lost our daughter to suicide, I have met dozens of people who dread coming out to their families, friends, or employers about depression for fear of it being held against them. Needless to say, I am a big advocate for getting help and support immediately. Someday science will find the answers to end all this soul-crushing pain, which in many cases people suffer through alone. Well, hear, hear to that. Let me get Dale on next. Dale, you're on. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. I'm a survivor, I guess you'd say. I've never attempted suicide, but I suffer from a condition known as tinnitus. It's ringing in the ears. There is no known cure for it. There are 3 million known sufferers in the United States. 6% of those have it so badly it disrupts their lives, and that I'm one of those. One of the problems, other than never hearing silence. I mean, to go into a forest where you expect to be in perfect silence, I hear this ringing in my ears. So being at the surf, hearing the ocean, things like that are far better for me. I've finally reached the point where I can ignore it, and I have to thank the Hearing Center of the North and a man named Dr. Robert Sweeto, who's one of the world's experts on tinnitus, to help me to deal with it. But being in a self-help group did immense therapy for me. I was able to, you know, suddenly realize I wasn't alone in the world, and that's about all I can say, right? I could go on and on, but those are the important points.
Well, I'm glad you made them, and again, I thank you for the call. It's a terrible condition when you have that ringing in the ears because you almost can't get rid of it. It's ubiquitous. Laura asks, can you talk about the role of anger in the complicated grief survivors feel? Maybe Joyce, can you? You didn't feel much anger?
No, I did. I felt anger. I had to take care of his affairs afterwards and all of the bills and things like that. And it was like, why? Why do I have to do this? And then, so that's how I felt anger. I felt anger about the extra things I had to do because of this. But I was very fortunate that my other two grown children took care of the apartment and the storage and all of that.
These were Devin's children? Yeah.
No, brother and sister.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
John, yeah, you want to talk about anger?
Well, speaking of anger, I was a rageaholic for years. what I didn't say was that we had a big fight with Casey before she jumped. So we had a fight with her during the weekend. Next morning, I woke up. She was gone. Her room was neat. And she left a note, and it just said, the car is parked at the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm sorry. So I felt like I might as well just have thrown her off that bridge. And so I was angry at myself, number one, because I failed miserably as a father. And I was angry at everybody around me. I was jealous and angry of people who had their kids. And I didn't have mine anymore. And they could just go on with life, and I was just stuck in this miserable hellhole. It really took 8 years now to kind of get back to some level of equilibrium, but I was really angry to be around.
Well, along with the sorrow, you have to deal with those kind of feelings as well. And, I mean, navigating, it's like Scylla and Charybdis. I mean, you're navigating through some pretty difficult territory there. I mean, the rage and yet you use the word rageaholic along with all that sense of loss.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to go to sleep and never wake up. Did not want to outlive my daughter by 1 second.
Let me get another call on. Jane, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I am the grandmother of a just 10-year-old boy who's a high-functioning autistic boy who's on medication. Recently, he has been telling me he wants to die, and I want to know if this is something that a kid just says, or if I ought to see what, I mean, I don't know what to do, and I don't think his parents do either.
First, I guess, Eli Merritt, depends on the kid, really, doesn't it? But what can you offer any advice or wisdom to her and her family?
Yeah, I think it's a statement like that. I would probably, in most every case, maybe there would be a few exceptions, really take that very seriously, not from the perspective of sudden alarm surrounding suicide risk, but it's a deep expression of, again, somewhere along the spectrum of the depression to hopelessness. And so two things I can think of. You know, one is to really try and help him find the right therapeutic pathway or a treatment plan that will help him with the autism and with the emotional consequences that are a result of that. And the other is to take that opportunity to, someone says, I don't want to live anymore. Again, to find your own way into the emotional space where you feel deep love and deep grief about that. And you hold that child in your arms and you tell them in tears how sad it would be for you to lose them.
Yeah, there's a sort of a common myth, and I hear it from kids all the time, who, when they're considering something as desperate as suicide, they believe that nobody will care, nobody will miss them, nobody's going to come to their funeral, mom and dad would be better off without me.
Of course, sometimes that's a kind of fantasy almost about, you know, the self-pathos. Yeah. They're going to feel my loss. There are people who, mm-hmm. Jumped off the bridge who made that pretty clear that that was part of their... here's Anita who writes, I've lost 4 people to suicide. I have been most struck by how people talk so negatively about those who commit suicide. People say angry things about them, calling them weak, blaming them. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about my loss much because some people are so quick to blame the deceased despite the suffering that led to their suicide. Thank you for this program. And thank you for that, Anita. And you are listening to Forum. And we are talking to a panel of people who have endured the loss of suicide here, Joyce Brady, Eli Merritt, and John Brooks, and this is a fundraising period for this radio station. For more information about how to support it, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me read another comment here from a listener. Actually, it's a question. Mary says, my 18-year-old niece jumped off a bridge into the Mississippi last week. She was pulled from the river alive. This was her second attempt. She's currently in a psychiatric facility, and her parents are trying to commit her. She has bipolar disorder. Does the panel or anybody on the panel have any recommendations on how to talk to her about why her family is supporting locking her up? I guess, Dr. Merritt, this would be your territory.
I want to make sure I understand the question. The question relates to how to talk to her about the fact that she's locked up, or how to talk to her.
She's asking how to talk to her about the fact that they have to lock her up or put her under lock and key.
That's a very good question. I would say that she's recently made a suicide attempt, and they love her, and they know the power of the feelings that can surround depression and hopelessness. And so they really want to help her to get through a very troubling, very challenging emotions and feelings, which ultimately, as we've, I think, discussed on the show already, in my experience in working with people, if you can find the right pathway, depression and suicidal feelings, no matter how long they last, they are transient. And people can really get well, and I'll even say go on to experience sort of a deeper sense of life, a deeper sense of gratitude, a deeper sense of sort of existential groundedness through dark pathways. That's happened in my 20s when I sort of went through the loss of my mother. And then again, you find it throughout philosophy and literature going back thousands of years. So not to pathologize these experiences, but to really help work through them.
Here's another call. And Heather, that's you. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is such a great program. I'm calling just to offer another perspective as someone who has attempted suicide and failed and survived. And more than anything, what I want to say is, A, my reasons for getting to that place had to do with terrible trauma and PTSD. That was nobody's fault. It wasn't my parents' fault. It wasn't my therapist's fault. It wasn't my fault. And I think that question or the way that we go to this place of blame is so natural, but so not helpful. And I just want to reassure all the people that are listening that, you know, it ran the course that it ran. Luckily, I'm here. I'm living a very productive life and enjoying my life. I've worked very hard to get to where I am. But, you know, I just don't think blaming ourselves is really helpful.
Well, thank you for that, Heather. Appreciate it. And let me go to the folks we have here in the studio. Joyce Brady, it seems to me you've done a marvelous job in not blaming yourself.
Well, it's not that I've done it. I think I realize that I can't control things. The main thing is control. I have no control over this.
Helplessness.
Control over what another person does.
But that's what I mean by helplessness.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to say is that most of the things we've been talking about are the medical model. I used to be a registered nurse. There are other models, too, that help me understand suicide other than the medical model. Like I read a book called Suicide and the Soul by James Hillman, who talks about people having this feeling of death, but they take it literally instead of metaphorically. Like there's some part of them, some area about themselves that has to die in order for them to evolve. So, and that gets all mixed up with, I'm going to kill myself. So there are other things that you can look at. In this culture, it's all the medical model. My son introduced me to Vipassana meditation. He was interested in Buddhists. His paintings say the wheel of life, but still he killed himself. But it's not, the medical model sometimes to me, it's this or it's that. And it isn't. There is mystery.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned, I knew Jim Hellman. I shouldn't speak of him in the
there
past tense.
There is mystery.
He's a Jungian, and he looks very much at mystery.
And individuation, how a person moves on with their own life.
John Brooks, you've moved on, but still self-blame?
Not so much. There was no magic panacea for me. There was no prayer or exercise or meditation. For me, nothing worked. It just simply took a lot of time. I went through, you know, my five stages of grief that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross writes about. And I think the one I'm in now is what I would call, she calls acceptance, I call resignation. So, you know, at this point, I'm resigned to live my life the best I can, make the most of a life that, frankly, I don't want. But it just took time for the blame to dissipate.
Well, good luck to all of you. Eli Merritt, I have to end with you. A six-year-old kid blaming himself, but when you were in your 20s, did you say maybe it was my fault or something along those lines and had to release yourself from that?
Tiny whispers of that, but no, not that was not major. But during the period of the emotions arising, there was a sizable amount of anger.
Thank you all. Thank you all for telling your stories. I really am grateful for your being here. Eli Merritt, again, is a psychiatrist at Merritt Mental Health. His book is called Suicide Risk in the Bay Area. And John Brooks is the author of The Girl Behind the Door. He'll be speaking at Books, Inc. in Alameda tomorrow and 7 o'clock at Books, Inc. in Palo Alto on Monday, May 23rd. And Joyce Brady lost her son, 52-year-old Devin. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.